Okay. So this English session this morning. Can you please kindly explain the difference in your view between Chinese Buddhism, Thai Buddhism, and other types of Buddhism? What are the similarities and differences? And since Buddhism originated from India, what is then the differentiator between Buddhism and Sikhism or Hinduism? Okay, well, this would probably be like a degree course in university then. I'll try to answer in 5 minutes. Yeah. So because I'm summarizing so much, this is like very general, okay? And so after the Buddha passed away, given that the different communities of monks were spread out throughout large area of northeast India, mainly, probably all the way from, say, Calcutta to Delhi, and there wasn't very much communication between them, you have inevitably got differences of emphasis. Let's say you had one teacher who was like a lot of metta, so maybe he'd emphasize all the metta teaching. Someone else who like really his own practice did a lot of asupa and stressed asupa. Someone else who was more scholarly and stressed more scholarly side. So you got those kinds of differences, natural, given the geography and the lack of communication. But you also had differences over the Vinaya, the monk's discipline. And the rule that came up right from the very beginning, and it's been a bone of contention or a cause of argument right up to the present day, is the use of money. And even right very soon after the Buddha passed away, there were already monks who didn't want to keep this rule and looking for ways of getting around it, really. There are also, in the attempts to systematize the teachings, then differences arose. So when we say the Pratipitaka, okay, so there are three things there. You have the suttas, which are the teachings of the Buddha, then the Vinaya, which is all about the monks' discipline and their own practice and all this sort of how to organize ordinations and all that what we call sankhagamma, the formal meetings of the sangha, how you deal with naughty monks, how you katinas and all these kind of ritual ceremonial things. All the rules concerning what kinds of kutis you can have and what things you can have in the kutis and what kinds of material your robes can be made out of and what your bowl can, it's huge. You know, when we, most people say the monk's discipline is 227 rules. That's only one part of the Vinaya. That's what we call the Patimokkha. In fact, there are thousands upon thousands of rules. Okay. Now, because the Buddha didn't teach in a systematic way, he didn't have like a textbook or a philosophy which he just expounded everywhere. His teaching, although it was based on timeless principles, the expression of it naturally over 45 years changed, just like any great teacher. If you say the same thing in the same way over and over again, people get bored or they don't pick it up. So you find fresh ways of expressing the same things. And this was the case with the Buddha also. Now, while the Buddha was alive, that was okay. But once the Buddha, or really monks were thinking about this before the Buddha passed away, and in order to be able to transmit this into the future for the next hundreds of years or thousands of years, it was necessary to create some kind of system. And for monks to look through all the teachings and try to pull out the main principles and make a structure, like a logical structure that could be preserved and studied and passed on. And this is what we call the Abhidhamma or the Praapitam came about. Now, when the monks started to do this, monks in different areas, different groups of monks, they come up with a little bit different system. And also, there are some gray areas where the Buddha didn't talk about something specifically, and yet these were like points of controversy in religious groups of that time. So monks say, look, we really be able to have to say, what's the Buddhist answer to this? For instance, you say, oh, the Buddhists say everything's impermanent, everything passes away. Well, then how do you explain memory? If something passes away, how can you remember it if it's already passed away? Where is it stored? So there were many different theories that came up to explain this. So if you look at all the different Tripitakas and different Sanskrit and Chinese and all the different renderings of the basic teachings, what you find is that if you look in the Pali canon, what we call the Pali canon, the discourses of the Buddha, and then you look in the Chinese translation or the Sanskrit translation, then it's like 90-95% the same. Very, very similar. And if you look at the Vinaya, is the same. But if you look at the Abhidhamma of each school, it's very different. So for that reason, I don't give the same weight to the Abhidhamma, because there's quite a lot of interpretation from the monks in the attempt to create a system out of something which was a much more spontaneous and without that kind of structure. Now, we don't really have a good word to explain that. There were like different schools, we can say. We have the problem in Thai because we have this word Nikai. And Nikai we use for within the Thai monastic order. We have Thammayut Nikai and Mahanikai. And then we'd use it to mean schools of Buddhism. So it's a little bit confusing. But schools of Buddhism that developed over time, we can put them into two kind of schools. Two kind of groups, okay? And one group I would call like the conservatives. And so the conservative idea is that the teachings the Buddha gave us are perfect, they're complete, don't need to be changed, don't need to take anything out, don't need to add anything. All we need to do is look after what the Buddha taught us and pass it on to future generations. Okay, that's the conservative idea of Buddhism. Now, there were probably about 20 different schools in this conservative group. And over the course of time, they all disappeared except for one. And that was the group that moved southwards into South India and then to Sri Lanka. And being on the island of Sri Lanka, then they were protected from persecution and from various dangers. And that Buddhism is what we now call Theravada. So that from Sri Lanka, then it spread to Southeast Asia. And so the Buddhism that we have in Thailand today is derived from the Theravada tradition that moves south from Northeast India to Sri Lanka. And similarly, is the Buddhism which is found in Burma and Cambodia and Laos and some parts of South Vietnam. Now, the other idea about Buddhism, and this is also, it has foundation in the Buddha's teaching, is that we shouldn't be so conservative idea is, look, this is the teaching. You can either like it or lump it. It means like if you're interested, I'll teach it to you. If you're not, then, you know, forget it. I'm not going to change it for you. but to make it more popular. But the Mahayana idea, this is the other group, the more kind of liberal group, is this is such a wonderful thing that we shouldn't attach to the less essential elements, should just keep the heart of the teaching, but be willing to adapt to different cultures and different environments so that the Buddha's teaching can spread. And of course, with that philosophy, it was much more likely to be successful. And this kind of Buddhism, what we call Mahayana, spread northwards into Kashmir, into Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. Most of those Stan countries were all Mahayana Buddhist at one time. And then, of course, to China and Tibet and to Korea and Japan. And because of this idea of being flexible, then it tended to change a lot more than the conservative schools and to adapt to the existing culture. So, for instance, in Tibet, the existing religious tradition was called Bun. And Bun is a kind of a mystical, shamanistic religion, a lot of magic. And that was absorbed into the Tibetan tradition. In China, of course, the dominant cultural tradition was Confucianism and Taoism. And so the Buddhism, the different schools, different Mahayana schools in China, developed this relationship, a kind of conversation, we can say, with Taoism and with Confucianism, was very affected by them. Now, an example, before Buddhism was really accepted in China, it was a few hundred years passed. And to give an example of how things changed with the Sangha, in India, from pre-Buddhist time, it's always been an accepted idea in the society that people who are following a religious quest should be supported. It's for the good of the whole society. If you have a certain number of people who are like religious professionals who don't have to worry about making a living and raising a family, but just can put every, can be like completely devoted, like scholars, you know, not have to worry about anything, just do your work. And so arms round and people making offerings of basic material support for religious figures was accepted part of Indian society. That's not the case in China. And in China, there's this ethos of hard work. If you don't work hard, you don't eat. And so when the monks from India went to China, they tried to go on Bindabat, nobody wants to put any food in. You say, you're a strong young man. You can go and work for it. Why should we give you anything to eat? And so this was a real obstacle. And over the course of time, they decided they need to just abandon many of the Vinaya rules that prevent monks from being independent. Because the Buddha didn't want the monks to be independent from the lay Buddhists. So a monk is not allowed to grow his own food, cannot even pick fruit from a tree, cannot cook, cannot store food overnight. So many of these different rules mean that there has to be a daily contact between the monks and the lay people in Theravada Buddhism. So to make sure that the monks don't just sort of go off and live in the mountains and never do any good for the society. But in the Mahayana, in China, they realized this wasn't working. So they changed the system and they started to buy land around the monastery and then to farm the land themselves. So the monks became farmers. And then they cook their own food. And so, of course, when the monks are preparing, cooking, planting, cooking their own food, then there was a move to vegetarianism, which wasn't possible for the Theravada monks who are dependent on the generosity of the local people. And the monks became more separate from society because they didn't have to rely on them for food every day. So this is the way that some of the teachings changed. And in the Mahayana then, also a lot of new teachings, new philosophies, which were developed by great monks. And some of them deviated more and more from the original. So if you see some of the Buddhist sects in Japan, for instance, their teachings are almost unrecognizable from the Theravada teaching. They move so far away. For instance, after about, let's say about 1,000 or more years ago, their teachers in Japan started to say, we're in the degenerate age. Human beings in this degenerate age don't have the potential for enlightenment in the same way that they did in the past. And we just have to be very humble and accept that. And so that being the case, there was no need for monks to be celibate. And monks have families and just be part of the community. And then there was this whole belief that there is a Buddha called Amitabha Buddha in a Buddha realm or a Buddha field. And if you could ask humbly for his kindness, then you could be reborn with him in his Buddha field and then be enlightened there. So you you have this Amitabha put, you know, sort of Amitofu, that whole idea of praying to what is really sort of praying to God or praying to Buddha, which is not so different from idea in Christian or theistic sects. So, you know, this is the way that things developed. Some of the schools that passed away or disappeared had very interesting ideas. For instance, the Theravada teaching is that if you become enlightened, you become a Sotapanna, Prasodaban, or one of the Aryabhukkhon, until Arahant, then that's there's no regress. You can't go back to being unenlightened once you've been enlightened. But there was a Buddhist sect that argued that you could, that if someone became enlightened and then they thought, oh yeah, everything's I'm okay now, and we're just kind of lazy and didn't practice, then it was possible that they could go back to being unenlightened again. One of the most influential ideas was that the realization of arahantship, to become an arahant, is not the highest enlightenment. There's something beyond that. And this they call Buddhahood. So the word Buddha has a different meaning in the Mahayana schools than it does in Theravada. So we have this, we're disciples of the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago in India. There's only one Buddha. But for people in Mahayana countries, then Buddha became like the highest level of enlightenment, and that people on like the fast track, this is the idea in Vajrayana Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism. They want to become Buddha. They don't want to become Arahant. They want to become Buddha because Arahant's not all the way there. This is right through the society. I mean, I'm walking through a Tibetan village a couple of years ago, and all the old ladies and all the old people come rushing out of their houses, and they're all saying, "Oh, a living Buddha has come to our home." That was how they expressed their faith. You know, whereas in Thailand you would say, "Oh, Prapatipatti Patipatthana Mabrot," and they would say, "Oh, a living Buddha has come amongst us." You see, so have a very different idea of what the word Buddha means. As I say, it could go on all day. Is there any further doubts about this? Anything you particularly, differences between different kinds of Buddhism? If there is, you can ask again later on. Does the concept of work hard, play hard get along with the Buddhist teachings? Well, I think it really depends on how you define the meaning of that phrase or idiom. What it does sometimes or often mean is that, you know, when you work, you just work like crazy, don't think about anything else, and then you get so stressed out that all you want to do is just go crazy and get drunk or do something really extreme to let out all the pressure that you've accumulated while you've been working hard. So I don't think it's a particularly wise attitude to life myself. I mean, when you're young, it kind of sounds cool, you know, but the older you get, the less cool it sounds. Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, the idea of what is the idea of working hard? What does that really mean? Like, work hard. And there's this kind of culture of like working incredibly long hours, particularly in America. And there's this idea that that's somehow heroic. You know, it's like, wow, you know, he took so many hours every there's a 100-hour week or whatever it is. And like, that's kind of something to be praised. I think it's a bit stupid myself, but you know, what do you want to do with your life? What are your values in life? And a lot of times these kinds of values are promoted and are used to brainwash people, frankly, in modern, particularly the American form of capitalism. Often that idea of a humane or caring relationship between management and workers is completely absent. And the idea is you've got so many people wanting jobs, you create that kind of situation where there's competition for jobs. You give a lot of money, and then you take people on, and then you just burn them out and throw them away and get someone new. But how do you get people who are willing to voluntarily allow themselves to get burnt to cinders and get thrown on the rubbish heap? Well, you tell them it's really heroic, and it's like work hard, play hard, that kind of thing. So I think it's really good to look in terms of big picture of your life and working life. And if you're working so hard that you really need to, the only way that you can relax is by, partying until the early hours and just going a bit crazy for a while, doesn't sound like such a balanced life to me. And I like the idea of balance and sustainability, and doing things which are creating good causes and conditions for long-term flourishing as a human being, rather than sort of short-term, make the best of things while you're young and just go for everything. That's my opinion. Anybody disagree? Anyway, quite welcome to disagree with me. I can like hear other people's opinions. Okay, why are there some words in the prayers? These are not prayers, these are chants, okay? Prayer means you pray to somebody. These are chants, which men and women have to pronounce differently. Anatito, anatita. And why do we mock grab long only during specific parts? Okay, well, as native Thai speakers, you should be able to work this one out. If you had someone from England saying, why at the end of the sentences do men say krap and women say ka? It's exactly the same. It's just the language. They have different forms at the end of the word which determine whether the speaker is a male or a female. Why don't you mok grap long only? Well, because if you mok grap long the whole time, you'd probably fall asleep. It would be a kind of weird way to chant. Your voice would be going into the floor rather than out into the hall. Yeah, it's just there's an interesting theory. You know, a number of the chants are taken from the Buddha's discourses, but some are poetic works. Some of them composed by Rajakanti C. Don, and I heard one theory that this bowing down like we do in the evening, chanting Gayena Vajayava Chetasawa, the theory is that Rajakanti C devised this, and he was adapting from the Muslim tradition. He looked at different religions. He looked at Christianity and Islam. And he liked this the way the Muslims bow down on their prayer mat, and so he incorporated that into the Thai chanting. Whether or not that's correct, I don't know. But these are conventions and forms developed over time in Thai Buddhism that you don't find them in other countries. Like for instance, Nang Papia. There's nowhere else I've ever seen in the world where people nang papir. In Burma, when they chant the Patimokkha, they nang yong yong. if you only ever see in Thai, you think, ooh, that doesn't look very, very beautiful. Doesn't look very, you know, because we have this perception that this is polite, this is rip roi, and nang papir, you know, ding the rip roi. But that's a convention that we have developed in Thailand. I think it is. I mean, it is. It does look nice, but it's not very practical. Before I became a monk, I used to sit meditation a lot. So I used to sit in cross-legged and thought, being a monk won't be a problem. And then I had to sit like this. It's so uncomfortable, you know, if you've never sat. Because it, like, yoga is always like a balance of left and right. And this is, you're all twisted to one side, aren't you? And you just kind of feel kind of weird. But now I like it. I'm used to it. Even when I sit on an aeroplane, as when I sit up here, if there's enough room to sit up here. How to block negativity and insecurities from your mind? How to not be insecure and negative? Okay, well, I've got some bad news for you, I'm afraid. Life is insecure. That's the point. It's really not secure at all. And you just have to get used to that. But there are different kinds of insecurities. Of course, I mean, what I say by insecurity is, your physical health is extremely insecure. Again, you're talking about youth. Like when you're in your 20s, in your teens and in your 20s, you know, you can abuse your body, you can do pretty well anything, and within a day or two, you feel okay again. But then when you get into your 30s and your 40s, it's not the same. If you're not careful with your body, suddenly you find it's really difficult to get back into balance again. And this body can go wrong on you very easily all the time. So the Buddhist idea is that we study, we bring these things into consciousness, we accept, we don't want them try to make the body other than it is. You know, we look after it, we give it rest, we give it good food, we exercise the body. but that doesn't give you a right, you know, to be healthy. And some people who do I've seen this over and over again, people who go to the gym every day and they do yoga and they eat vegan and they do all these incredible things. And it builds up this idea of, I have a right to be healthy because of all the effort, all the time that I've invested, all the money I've invested in looking after my body. You don't. You don't have any guarantees at all. No guarantees. You have a better, obviously it's better to do all those things than not to do them, to look after your body. But never think that because you do all those things, you're safe, everything's going to be all right. Because it's not the way that human life is. And that's a heedless and dangerous way to look at things. Now, in terms of, what can you do? You can have, there are a lot of insecurities that are created by our own thinking, by dwelling on things too much. And this can be arrested or can be lessened by mindfulness and by being aware of what's going on in your mind. And when your mind starts to dwell on the negative side of things, so this is where the negativity comes in, it's always taking something and just going over and over and over and over and over and over it again. So it's just a habit, a mental habit that we develop without realizing, and it can be something we started when we were kids or maybe even from past life. But that's all it is. It's not who you are. You just have a habit of dwelling on the negative. But in fact, this is a human characteristic, and evolutionary psychologists and these kind of people will point out that human beings are like hardwired to give more importance to bad news than good news. Reason is if there's good news, so if you walk 10 kilometers up that way, there's a mango grove and you have some beautiful fruit to eat. Okay, that's good news. And then, but if you don't go all that way, there's maybe something else you can eat in the meantime. Good news is not like a matter of life and death. But if you say there's a man-eating tiger who was seen down in the garden this morning, you know, you really need to take, you can't just put that in the back of your mind and, don't forget that. You need to know it, because if you don't remember and you don't bear it in mind, you may end up dead. So bad news tends to be a matter of life and death. Good news, not so much. So over the course of time, this is the theory, human beings become a lot more tuned into bad news. So that means that you have to, make a conscious effort to move your mind in the direction of good news more, and not to start looking in the world as more negative than need be. So it's not like trying just to develop positive thinking, but to look more closely at the complexity of what's going on. And there are things that we need, bad things, negative things, that we need to take note of. Don't just turn your back on them. But there are also a lot of good things. And if you read a newspaper, of course, newspaper is full of bad things usually. But don't conclude from that, therefore, the world is a bad place. But if you look at your own personal world, rather than the so-called world of that you can find in Google Maps or in a geography textbook, but let's say the world of your experience, meaning the people around you, the people that you know and you relate to every day, and then you say, what's the ratio of good news to bad news in your real world, your personal world? It's quite the opposite. There are far more good and positive things going on in your own personal world than in the conceptual world that you find in newspapers. And so that's the balance. It's like I say, this isn't a kind of just think positive and don't think negative. That doesn't work, and it's not very intelligent thing to do either. But it's more having that faith that if you open your mind up and you look around you a little bit more closely, then there's a lot more good and wholesome and positive things going on. So the one more thing in terms of a sense of security, a wise or intelligent sense of security, then most important thing is keeping precepts. Keeping the five precepts is what gives a sense of security and safety more than anything else. And so I'm just going to carry on because this is the last day. So if anybody's really keen to meditate, you can just go downstairs and meditate by yourself. Otherwise, does anybody want to do that? No, okay. Didn't think so. When expectations lead to disappointment, how do you stop yourself from expecting things from your loved ones? Well, again, we bring this up and we study this. This is part of life, expectation. And ask yourself, what expectations do you have of yourself? What expectations do you have of others? Do we suffer because of our expectations? Do we need to suffer because of our expectations? What kind of expectations are realistic? What kind of expectations are unrealistic? So these are the kind of questions we need to be asking ourselves. And sometimes, you know, we can be really unrealistic, I think, in the sense that we maybe loved ones, we want them to be perfect. And this, as you're growing up, I think this is like a turning point in your life, the first time when you realize that your parents are not perfect, you know, because they're like gods when you're a child, small child, and your father, your mother, like the authority on everything. And they're the model, they're the leader, they're the God. And then one day you suddenly realize that they have weaknesses, they have faults, they have insecurities, they have suffering. And it's like an earthquake the first time. Everything you thought was so solid. It's your whole sense of, you know, we live in a solid, reasonable, safe world. Is based on your relationship to parents, and then the first time you realize that they haven't got this worked out either, you know, they're just making it up as they go along as well. That's really you know, frightening experience. If you see parents in a state of despair or suffering, it's such a terrible thing to see. Not just because of the compassion you feel for them, but what that means in your world, that the pillars, those things that tell you this is a stable, dependable world are not so stable. This is why when they talk about earthquake, if anybody's been in an earthquake, it's not just the danger of the earthquake, but psychologically, it's incredible, stressful to see the earth, the very earth that you've just taken for granted all your life, is suddenly, it's not still, it's not solid anymore. It can break apart. This can happen with parents. So the more that you're willing to recognize that, you have to be able to take that on board and not feel resentful or angry that that's been taken away from you. And having realistic assumptions and realistic expectations of friends, realistic expectations of loved ones, romantic partners or school friends or wherever it is. Yeah, we all have weaknesses and defilements and vices, and we have to be able to accept that and not to say they shouldn't be that way. Doesn't mean we just like passive accept everything, but yeah, there are causes and conditions that underlie the situation, and we can't just feel resentful at it or upset or disappointed, because it's just not fair, is it, really? I mean, if someone's never promised you that they would be a certain way, but you decide for yourself you want them to be that way, and then when they're not, even though they never said they were in the first place, it's not their fault if you're disappointed, is it? It's something you've created in your own head. So this part of mindfulness is being careful about what kinds of expectations we have of other people and making them as fair and realistic as we can. Okay, the train dilemma. Does anybody heard of the train dilemma before? This is, if any of you are interested in social science and ethical dilemmas, and this is probably the biggest one of the last 20, 30 years, and there are many, many different forms of it. So the questioner has given one form of this and a diagram. So here is the, let's say we have a train loose. You can't stop it. If you do nothing, the train will run over 5 people. But if you pull a switch, then it will go that way and kill 1 person. So what would you do? Do you just allow it to kill 5 people? Or do you stop it and then you personally are responsible for the death of 1 person? This is the train dilemma. So they... And as I say, they've come up with so many different variations on this to test people's feelings and responsibility of it. So what do you think, Ajahn Chil? As a monk, you see, it's more straightforward because you wouldn't ever interfere and kill the 1 person. That's how a monk, I understand a monk. But my hesitation with all of these ethical dilemmas is that they're so simplified. You know, in any situation, there's just so complex all the different things and pressures and considerations. And that these are I'm hesitant to even give answers with these kind of things because in real life there's so many more. It's not just a simple matter of A or B. There are so many different things going on and other alternatives. You're saying if there are no alternatives, but that's the point. How do you know there are no alternatives? You'd look for other alternatives. If there's 5 people up there, maybe you could just shout out, "Get off the track," you know, something like that. I don't really have I don't like these kind of ethical dilemmas because I think you're being set up by the person who sets up the who. Establishes the conditions and that they're unrealistic. But let's look at this in sort of a big picture kind of way. That this whole idea, and I think it's one which it is worth talking about, this idea of sacrificing a minority for the benefit of the majority. So you, this is an argument come across in various forms in many ways, isn't it? You know, so let's start this off. Let's say, okay, 67 million people in Thailand, and you were told that if you were to shoot Mr. Gore over here dead, then you would save 67 million people. So would you do that if you had that kind of choice? So I'm setting this up now. Would you be willing to do that? Kill one person to save 67 million lives? Let's have a show of hands. Don't worry. I'm going to judge you or anything. What do you think? Who would think that would be a worthwhile kind of thing to do? If you don't, you've got to explain why not. No? Okay, it's all right if you do. I'm not going to say bad people. Okay, those someone who doesn't agree. Can you give me a reason why you wouldn't agree? Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's the train. I thank you for that. But I'd like to come back to this, like, kill one person to save 67 million. Okay, this man's got this virus, and this virus has no cure. And this you just leave this person, and here everybody in Thailand will die. Okay? So so that's the kind of bodhisattva idea, and that idea is actually appears in the Mahayana Buddhist teaching on bodhisattva. But so I think that probably there would be many people, even majority of people, who would say, yeah, to save 67 million lives, I would take one. But then let's say, okay, what about killing 1 million people to save 66 million? That's still a huge profit. I mean, it's like 66 million saved and only 1 million die. Okay, what about 2 million to save 65 million? Or kill 20 million to save 47 million? Would you do that? 20? What's the difference? Yeah, but you still save 47 million. Yeah. You see, this is the problem with this idea of, you know, you sacrifice a minority to save the majority. You know, some people have to just make those sacrifices. Where do you draw the line? You know, what about 67 million and you kill 35 million, 30 million in order to save 37 million or 32 to, you know, where do you stop? And what reason do you stop if you're putting forward the view that the majority must come first? So, you know, for me, it's the moment you make that first choice that one person's life is less important, or like life can be quantified, then you're on this slippery slope and it's difficult to get off it. Okay. But anyone who's interested, you can Google. I'm not sure if it's called The Train Dilemma, and there's a lot of stuff on the internet about this because it's a lot of research and a lot of discussion of it. Today, we see so many temples being run like business, sending monks to work at weddings, house openings, birthdays, asking followers to give donations in return for luck and boon, amulets and charms. Does this not go against the core beliefs of Buddhism? First of all, you know, it's often the case that it's the lay people coming to the monks and asking for all these things, and corrupting the monks as much as the monks corrupting the lay people, I think. But There are, you know, I was talking earlier about the vinaya, the monk's discipline, and although you don't expect to know huge amount, there are certain rules that you should know, because often in Thailand, in Buddhist culture, everyone's afraid of making like a bap of anything concerning monks. If a monk asks you for something, it's very difficult to say no, isn't it? That's why monks are taught, you know, just be very, very careful before you ask anything from a layperson, because it's very difficult for them to say no to you. That's how I was taught and how I teach. But one thing that you need to know is that a monk is forbidden from asking anything from a layperson except water, if he's very thirsty. And these days, water is more expensive than oil for your car. So even that one, unless it's water from a tap. But a monk can only ask for something from other person. If all his robes have been stolen and he's wandering around naked, he can ask for a piece of cloth. He's half dead, he can ask for some water. Other than that, he's not allowed to ask for anything except if the person has offered bawarana. And bawarana means you make an official, like formal invitation to a monk or a monastery. You say, I would like to offer bawarana. And you can offer bawarana for specific things or a general bawarana. So let's say you live around here and you have free time and you've got a car, and you say, Ajahn, if you ever need to go into Bangkok for some business, I'd be very happy to give you a lift. I give you bawarana. Or somebody said, if you need to catch a train somewhere, I would like to offer bawarana to offer the train ticket. There's a very generous one of my lay supporters who said, Ajahn, if you ever want to visit your mum in England, I would like to offer bawarana for a plane ticket. So that's a very generous bawarana. But it can be from very simple things, like if you need someone to come and do some tidying up around Ban Bun, I offer bawarana, I'd be happy to come and do some. It can be anything at all. But you have to be this form. You say, I'd like to offer bawarana. You have to make it very clear with the monk that you would very much like to do this. Only then can he ask you. The other case is if you're a blood relative of the monk. So I could ask my mother or my brother or my sister if I were really desperate. But I couldn't ask for my brother-in-law or sister-in-law because they're not blood relatives. So those are the only conditions in which a monk is allowed to ask anything. If a monk asks for anything, particularly money or donations, then that monk is breaking his precept, and that monk is bap. And so if a monk asks for a donation and you don't know that monk, or he phones you up, or he and tries to put some pressure on you, then you're actually supporting him doing something wrong. It's not bun. It's the opposite of bun. So don't feel intimidated. Don't feel that, oh, because a monk asks you, you have to do that. Otherwise, you know, it'd be a really bad thing. This is why it's important to know some of these rules, particularly the ones concerning monks and lay people, that make sure there's a correct relationship between the monks and the lay people. As women, you need to know that monks are not allowed to be alone with a woman, ever, any place. And a monk is not allowed to speak alone with a woman more than 6 sentences or 6 words, mean like absolute. Just if somebody says, I just been bitten by a snake. Where's the hospital? Do you know where the hospital is? Then a monk can say, yes, you go up here and you take. you can do that, you know. So it's like really like important things. So don't ever get in that situation where you're alone talking with a monk, because it may well be that everyone has completely pure, proper intentions, but that's not always the point. Maybe that monk has an enemy and he wants to gossip about that monk. He said, that monk, he was sitting alone with that young woman. I don't know what they were talking about. And then that gets about, and then your reputation is pulled into question, and the monk's reputation. And so these are very wise rules that the Buddha laid down to protect the sila and the reputation of both the monk and the lay woman. And then the monks are not even allowed to touch money. They're not allowed to use money. So if a monk, for instance, was to accept money from layperson, then he'd make a serious offense in his discipline. And if he was to go and buy something with that money, that's a second offense. And then if he, like, let's say I went and bought this, you gave me some money, some cash, and I went and bought this. Every time I use it, then that's another offense. Bap, tukrang. So every time a monk uses something that he bought himself, he creates more bad karma. So there are very clear, precise rules. And a lot of the problems in the Sangha in Thailand these days is because almost no monks keep these rules. There, I don't know if it's even 5%, not probably 5%. It's the monks in the forest monasteries in northeast Thailand and a few isolated monasteries throughout the country. But this is, one of the main reasons for the corruption in the monastic order. So, this is, don't ever put cash money into monks' bowls on alms round, because that more than anything else creates this likelihood of people dressing up as monks, like fake monks. If you dress up as a fake monk, you can make a lot of money in Bangkok in the morning on alms round. So don't do that. There's a lot of these kinds of things going on, and you don't have to be very outspoken and critical, but just if you see monks who are not keeping the monk's discipline or acting in these kinds of ways, then don't support those monasteries, don't support those monks. Well, this is why there's so much emphasis on wisdom and understanding, because if you make a cash donation or something, then there's what I was talking about, like a purification. Yeah, you're giving something that you, like, hard-earned money, you worked for that, you made that money in an honest way, and you're giving it away out of kindness. Then that's bun, that's something that... But if you look on the big picture, if you're not careful, then that can actually have more detrimental effect than not. So it's good constantly to be considering these things and not just taking that generous impulse as the proof that therefore it's right or a good thing to do. Again, it a little bit depends on who that monk is. And if it's a monk who's like who'd known your family for a long time, and it's someone that, really he should get in touch with a male member of the family rather than a young woman. That's not really correct. But if it's if your family are like longtime supporters of the monastery, and that monk is sure you'd really like to know, and you'd probably be a bit upset or noijai if you didn't know, you know, then you can understand why he would say. But if it's a monk that you don't know, you don't have any, you've never been to Tambun at that monastery, you don't have any kind of connection, and then out of the blue you say, "Who's that?" Oh, I'm the abbot of, I live in this monastery in northeast Thailand, and it's so hard. We're trying to build a sala, and we haven't got the roof on. As 5 years have passed by, and we really need, you know. So really try to manipulate your kindness. Then no. So it is a matter of the intention of the monk also. And as I say, you do have a sense if it's someone. Sometimes there's not so much, I was talking about that specific bawarana, but a monk knows that, yeah, in this case, that person would really appreciate to know, to be able to contribute to something without making a... Not if it depends exactly how it's put, you know, and certainly if it's not like a direct appeal for funds, but on the basis of a previous connection, a relationship with the family, to let them know that there is something, a merit-making activity going on. But, you know, for me or for monks, I'm saying, when I teach young monks, never put a layperson in a position where they feel that they can't say no. That's really what, you know, so that they don't feel... Grengjai, that, you know, they don't really want to do it, but they, you know, they'll do it anyway because they don't want to have a ruang with a monk, you know. So yes. Yeah, it depends. Like mostly, I go on arms round in the villages in like Dangjang Wat. So then everybody knows that you're coming, and they're already standing outside their houses. In Bangkok, it's a bit different because you never know. You may be someone. Sometimes somebody parks their car, and then they jump out of their car and say Nimon. There was where I used to go at Bindabat in Bangkok. There used to be a lady who go jogging every morning, and she had like a tray on her head. She was running along like this, and then when she sees a monk, she stops and she nimonka and she say bad, and then starts jogging again. You know, so you have to be a bit more flexible. Yeah. But what is an offense is if a monk is walking along this side of the road, and that's his route. And then he sees out the corner of his eye, there's a really wealthy person, maybe with envelopes, with money and things over there, and then he just sort of crosses the road. And you do see that sometimes, unfortunately. So, you know, then that's not beautiful and not correct if monks are just following their greed. But I think that the best thing, well, monks should have a particular route and stick to that route. But if someone does call out and say, you know, nimon ka, nimon, you know, usually monks will stop. And I think in Bangkok, the dilemma for a monk is often that your bowl is full already. And if you don't have like a luksit or someone with you, because I don't usually have that necessarily, then somebody wants to offer you food, and then I've said before, I'm sorry, my bowl's full. You know, thinking people say, okay, I'll give it to someone else, and then someone get angry. You know, say, you know, like no metta. You know, I wonder, but actually, you're not supposed to take more food than, you know, over the edge of your bowl. But people give you like a big bag, and then You know, as a monk, you're walking through, and I hate that, you know, walking along with bags like this, you know, saying, what are you going to do with all that food, you know? So, yeah, that's not correct. I mean, that's not how it should be done. Sometimes monks sit on a chair, and sometimes you probably know the monks have an agreement with the owner of the stall. So once they receive it, then they give it back, and then they at the end they get paid by the stall holder. So there are all kinds of that corruption like that these days. But generally in Thailand, the correct way is that a monk has a route, and if he's older and not so, he makes a short route. But just to stand there and wait for people to come is not correct. But the reason why, in England or in any Western country, then monks stand. Because if you just walk like we walk in Thailand, in England, nobody would put food in your bowl. They don't know what you're doing. They're kind of, it's just too kind of weird, you know. In England, you know, we go to the middle of a town and you stand there like this. And then it's incredible. People come and they say, and they want to give you money. Almost everybody wants to give you money. And then you say, I'm sorry, I don't take money. And then they got even more intrigued, you know, what do you want? We want to give you something, you know, and they say, we can only take food. This is for food. Oh, okay. Just don't go anywhere. Just stay there. Okay. And then people go in Tesco's or something, and they come out with all this food, you know, it's like incredible. And we when the monks went to the West, we never thought that like Tudong would be possible in the way we do it in Thailand. And you wouldn't believe, like 2 years ago, two monks, they walked from our monastery in North California in Redwood Valley to Branch Monastery, which is on the border between Oregon and Washington, like over 1,000 kilometers. And they had no lay people with them, just two monks. And they binned about every day, places they'd never been before, people who are not Buddhist, never seen a Buddhist monk before in their life. And I think there was only two or three times that they didn't get any food in walking 1,000 kilometers through the middle of America. So there's something very special when monks are walking on arms. You know, it really seems to bring out the good in people if it's done in a correct way. And as I say, particularly if the monks don't take money, but it's only wanting food to keep themselves healthy and alive. Okay, we've run out of time for your lunch. So we can end the session.